Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 210, recorded Monday, July 27th, 2015. Lance Ulanoff. Triangulation is brought to you by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service that is the most sophisticated way for you to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit wealthfront.com/triangulation to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's wealthfront.com/triangulation. And by Varidesk. Convert your existing desk or cubicle into a standing desk. Varidesk is height adjustable and lets you easily switch between sitting and standing. To learn more, visit varidesk.com. That's V-A-R-I-D-E-S-K.com. And by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 Visa gift card when you get a loan. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we cover and talk to some of the most interesting people in technology, spend some time with them. You get to spend some time, too. If you're watching live, you can use our chat room to ask questions, to pass along your thoughts and suggestions. I'm pleased, thrilled, in fact, to have Lance Ulanoff on the show today. I've known Lance for a long time, but something like 20 years in the business covering technology. He's been on TWiT many times. Currently chief correspondent at Mashable. Lance, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I'm glad I could
slot right in here.
Yeah, no, we've been wanting to get you on, so this is the timing is actually excellent. You started as a general purpose reporter, right, in your career?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was just talking to somebody today about, I don't know, we started talking about Macs, and because I'm typically on Windows, and they're like, oh, you've always been a Windows guy? I go, no, I was on Macs. I used to train people on Macs in the 80s, and they looked at me like, what? But that was actually right around the start of my career. When I was a general purpose reporter at a weekly newspaper, was when they were bringing in Macs for the first time, and I had actually interned at a place which had Macs, I'm sorry, had a Mac and had one version, PageMaker version 1.2.
Whoa.
And I trained myself on it. And after that, every time I went to another job, it seemed like they were introducing the Mac for layout purposes. So I did train an entire weekly newspaper staff on the Mac and then redesigned the paper on the Mac. So, yeah, I was doing a lot of stuff at that time, but definitely general reporting, too, doing the school board meetings and
wow.
the local murders and all of that stuff you do as a beat reporter. I was pretty much working 24/7, it seemed, but I was very hungry at the time.
You know, though, I wonder how much of that goes on anymore, because that's something that only a local newspaper can do. And as the newspaper industry has shrunk, no national website's going to cover a school board meeting.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I think that was a really important part of the news business. You know, obviously, AOL tried the patch to sort of revive it and then kind of pulled the plug on it. It's still stumbling along little bits and pieces. But
yeah, we still have Petaluma patch. I guess they're volunteers.
I don't know. It's volunteers. It's people who just want to get, but they don't have the resources to cover things. And we didn't have a lot of resources either. I was like one of two reporters. And then when I worked when I was the editor of one of the local newspapers, I was everything. but
that's such an important public service.
It really is. Local elections. It was very interesting to me. It was really fascinating to learn all the intricacies and the fighting and the sort of socioeconomic issues that exist in the world that people talk about all the time. In microcosm, we're right there in these small towns being played out. And so I was writing these stories. I was writing editorials. And actually, it's funny because all these years separated from it, it sticks with me. And it's stuff that's still in the back of my head and I think about. And sometimes when I read national level stories, I think back to my days and I think I understand why this happened because I understand how these places work. But in any case, it's kind of a dying area. These newspapers, all of them, the ones that still exist, and there are a handful, you know, in various communities around the country, they've all consolidated.
Yeah.
And they don't, they don't really even that then have the resources to cover, because now they're covering larger areas and they can't cover the local school board.
Yeah. We have in Petaluma, a town of 55,000, we still have a local paper, but it's owned by the New York Times. So,
interesting.
Yeah. So, I wonder. Then the other thing you see, and in fact, we're seeing it this week, is the nation's journal of record, the New York Times, seems to be going down a not so great road.
Gosh.
What do you think? Because, well, let me give an example. This the story that they published that the Department of Justice was launching a, and they use the word criminal investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails, and then they edited it bit by bit to take out the word criminal, and then it turned out it weren't, they weren't investigating her, and it got to be a smaller and smaller story. And you, I just was reading a rebuttal of their piece, very, very big piece on nail salons, the scandal of nail salons, that said, you know, this is, none of this is accurate. And I'm starting to wonder if the standards even on the big national papers are changing because the money situation is changing.
Well, I think the money situation is changing. I think the process, the processes that exist for vetting the news have changed radically. And I think that's one of the big areas. So, you know, in that particular story with Hillary Clinton, their information came from a number of sources who all led them astray. I have to believe that they led them astray on purpose, because how damaging can it be to her campaign to have the word criminal associated with her name? And you even see her dropping in the polls temporarily, I'm sure. But, you know, I think back to my career and when I was at PC Mag, and we had a team of fact checkers.
Yeah.
All they did.
Yeah.
I've not worked on a publication that's had a team of fact checkers in 15
it's
years.
It's over.
And, you know, the New York Times in particular is one of those media outlets that is struggling with the slow and steady decline of their print business, which is a drag on money, which means they have to address it and by cutting resources. And you know that they must have cut, you know, they're cutting corners. They're also rushing the story out. And we've seen this with many people. You know, we talk about the Rolling Stones story, where they had something and they totally botched it because they didn't do the next step. They didn't check. They wanted to get the story out there. So this is happening a lot. It's unfortunate. I think that has a lot to do with the competition out there. And it also has a lot to do with the economics of media. And when you see the newspaper of record make this mistake, you know that it has completely permeated the business.
Well, and one of the reasons I'm fascinated to talk to you about this is because you're now, you were editor-in-chief of Mashable, you're now chief correspondent of Mashable, which is the exact other side of the all the pressure that's coming on these old-line media outlets is coming from outlets like Mashable that move faster, are better able to create viral content, that are better, as a result, able to monetize their content. So you're seeing it from both sides.
Yeah, yeah, and you don't have... You know, certainly we don't have the distribution pressure, you know, the financial distribution pressure that a company like the New York Times has or the Washington Post has. We're able to, you know, put it out on the internet and that we've distributed it instantly. And I think that there's no sense of freezing anything in print. You're able to get it up online, but you're also able to take as much time as possible right up until that point when you're putting it up there to feel that it's 100%. You do have to put a lot of pressure on your writers to get it right the first time. I think there's definitely that can be difficult. But, you know, I mean, I've seen have it, my career has definitely seen both sides. I mean, I worked in print when I started. I worked in print magazines, major print magazines, you know, in the 90s. I was the guy, you were looking at the guy who ended print at PC Magazine.
Oh, really? You were there when that happened? Wow.
Oh, yes. Oh,
wow,
yes.
Wow, wow, wow.
Did
you follow, when I worked at Ziff Davis, it was Bill McCrone, who was editor-in-chief of PC Magazine. Mm-hmm. And by the way, PC Magazine, there is no more prestigious name in technology reporting, in technology and journalism. They owned the market in the 90s. They were making, they were minting money.
It was incredible.
It was amazing. Then after Bill,
Michael.
That's right. And he,
Michael Miller.
Mike Miller was great. And then you followed Michael Miller?
No, it was Jim Louderback.
Louderback.
That's right. Louderback, and then it was me.
Okay. I mean, this was the pantheon. I don't know if people know this today, but this was the pantheon of technology journalists. These guys were on Mount Olympus running the most influential, most powerful magazine in technology. PC Magazine said something was good. You were made. It said something was bad. That's the end of the line. Nobody has that power today, by the way. That's
no, wrong. No, it's widely distributed. You know, when I was there in the 90s, I joined in 91, and I wasn't that aware of it at the time. I was into computers, but as I said, I was actually a Mac guy, so it wasn't really my book. I got there, and it was overwhelming. First of all, they were producing 500 pages every 2 weeks. That's the folio. So obviously there's ads, and we had a lot of ads.
Oh, man. And it came out every other week. I mean,
every other week. And it was full of, I'm not exaggerating when I say it was full of some of the most intelligent people I had ever met. If you want to feel like an idiot, that's the environment to walk into. It was just overwhelming. But it was like boot camp. You know, 5 years I worked there the first time, totally like boot camp. I couldn't have worked in a better place. So exciting. And that power you talk about was palpable. I mean, we gave out an Editor's Choice Award. It transformed businesses, absolutely transformed businesses. They were, what they said is that PC Magazine was writing for the influencers.
Yep.
They were the people who had the ear of the people making the buy. If they told them, this is the computer, this Zeos, this Gateway, this Dell, well, they bought them in the hundreds, if not thousands. It was really remarkable and very intense. I mean, you felt sometimes like you were living inside a computer.
I remember going to Comdex. That'll date you when you say that word. And, man, the people who were there from PC Magazine were royalty. And everybody just, you know, wanted to talk to you. And, of course, the Spencer the Cat party. Spencer the Cat was the gossip columnist. That was the ticket. And you'd see people like Bill Gates and Michael Dell dancing. I mean, it was an interesting time.
Those were the guys.
It's a really interesting time. We're talking to Lance Uhlenhoff, chief correspondent for Mashable. He has been involved in the magazine and the PC technology coverage since the 90s, as you heard. Also at Windows Magazine, Mike Elgin's publication.
That's right.
You worked with Mike, I would imagine.
Yes,
right?
Mike and I did work together.
Yeah.
He was a good guy. And, you know, we always kept in touch after. And obviously, I've been on TNT with him.
Yeah, we love Mike.
A number of times. But, he was a lot of fun. He was kind of one. You know, there were a number of people in the industry at that time who I was kind of in awe of, you know, that they were, you know, they were names, they were columns, they were...
Dvorak.
I always tell the same story about Dvorak, that many years before I met him, I saw him as a standee holding his book in a bookstore. So this is a guy, like, you know, so when I started working with him, it was like, at first I couldn't wrap my head around it. I was working with this guy.
He was the king of the end cap, man. That guy owned those end caps. Those are the displays at the end of the shelves. Remember bookstores? They used to be places you'd go in and they'd have physical books that you could buy. And the key place to be was at the end of the bookshelf. They called those the end caps. And John was always good. But he would go into bookstores and he would turn his books around to face out. So they took more shelf space and were more visible. He'd literally do that.
That's totally Dvorak. So he was one of the, you know, certainly he was, I didn't get to work with him until the second time I came back to Mag. But I worked with Mike Elgin at Windows. And actually, that was after working at Home PC. Another magazine that for a time was really popular.
Who published that?
I was also CMP. So I went from Ziff to CMP. It was one of those times where 5 years down the line, it wasn't doing well. They sold it. I had to find another job within the company or elsewhere. It ended up, I was able to very quickly go right into Windows Mag. And, that was, again, when Windows Mag started, I was at PC Magazine, and I will never forget how upset we were. You know, and we was, as a company, we were so upset, we launched Windows Sources.
That's right. That was Ed Bott.
Yeah, which was, you know, no offense, was never as good. Yeah. It was sort of, it was, a response. And right. I never think it's good to just develop something as a response. But, you know, Windows Magazine, I was, by the way, when I worked in those publications, I should make it clear, I had switched to being online because I was convinced that was the future.
Well, you were way ahead of the curve, if that's the case.
Well,
wow.
It's funny. If people look up, if you ever go to Google Books and search PC Mag, you'll find a 95 story called How to Build Your Own Website.
Oh, my, my.
That was my baby. And doing that feature story got me hooked. Got me hooked on HTML, got me hooked on the web. And I was convinced I had to be there. I had to work on it. And I started campaigning to work on it at Ziff. But the timing wasn't quite right. They didn't have a place for me until I told them I was leaving. And then they were scrambling to make a place for me. But I was already out the door.
Did they think you were nuts? I mean, this web thing, this is not going.
I think they had given me a lot of responsibility at Mag. They had handed me, I had all software coverage because they had like teams covering graphics hardware and then software. Business software, graphic software, and they're like, okay, well, all the software's going to go together, so, and then we'll move this over here. So I was very effective, and I would manage big stories without so much as a peep, just make them come in on time, and so they didn't want me to stop doing that job. But I was like, I have to work online. Give me a job online.
Interesting.
And I found one, and then they were like, please don't leave.
Did that mean that you didn't go into the office? Is that what you're talking about, or...?
Oh, no, it meant that I stopped working on the print product.
And when online. Wow.
Yeah, this was, so 96, I started at Home PC as their only online editor. Every time I would, those days, if you got hired as the online editor, you were the entire operation.
Editor, you're everything.
You had to build every bit of every web page. Oh, and they also had, do you remember the AOL, when AOL had all these sites, that every, Oprah had a site on AOL, and everybody had all these special sites on AOL, because AOL had its own platform. It wasn't the web. Oh, you could get to the web through AOL, but there was this other area that they were very interested in making sure it survived, and it had its own development platform. And I remember, after working on this for a while, telling my editor-in-chief, I said, look, this is a dead end. You want to throw all your resources into working on the web.
Wow, were you right on.
This is not going to survive. And I don't want to do it. I'm going to work on the web.
But at the time, they must have thought you were nuts.
I know. Well, they did, but they listened to me.
Good.
They listened to me, and that site grew a lot and did really well. But again, the problem with these magazines at that time is they couldn't survive. And Windows Magazine, I had at least a team, and we lasted a while. But as I'm sure Mike has told you, it just,
Well,
that was a situation where they let everyone go except the online team.
Oy. That was a little too prescient. We're going to take a break. Yeah. We're talking to Lance Ulanoff. He's currently chief correspondent at Mashable.com. And I guess kind of, I'll have to say, like me, is an old timer and has been through a lot of changes, but unlike me, he's worked through the print and the online side, and I'm just fascinated. We'll talk more in just a second with Lance Ulanoff. I do wish to tell you right now about something very cool. Most of the time when we advertise a product, it's a product I use. I can't use this one. SEC regulations prohibit me, and it's driving me nuts, but you can. It's called Wealthfront. See, the SEC says that you can't have customer testimonials to advertise an investment product. So if I were a customer, I couldn't talk about it. But let me tell you, this is Silicon Valley's answer to the expensive on-commission investment advisor. Wealthfront makes it easy for anyone to access world-class, now I want to say this, long-term, this is not day trading, long-term investment management. You could start today with a minimum of $500. Now, normally, if you use a traditional advisor, you're paying between 1% to 3% of the money you have under management, plus, of course, all those fees for transactions and charges for, random stuff. This is not that way. In fact, the deal is you pay 1/4 of 1%. Did you get the difference? Between 1% and 3% a year? Nope. 1/4 of 1%, no commissions, no hidden fees. If you had, let's say, a $30,000 account, we're talking about $5 a month. And by the way, they do a better job. They do a better job. You saw a second ago on the website, The Random Walk Down Wall Street. He's one of the managers there. It was one of the classic books on investing. And Wealthfront is using these incredible investment principles. There it is, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, to make you money. And they're doing some interesting things like tax loss harvesting and direct indexing to optimize your after-tax returns. So they're going to lower your tax bill, increase your money, and charge you less to do it. It's a win all round. You can sign up for an account right now at Wealthfront.com. By the way, that won't cost you anything. You can actually get a portfolio from them and see what they would invest in. That's a good idea to just kind of see what you would be investing in. The software does all the work. It optimizes your investment for the best risk-adjusted return, net of taxes and fees. And that's, I don't think anybody is as sophisticated doing this. This is the way to do it. It's transparent. It's accessible. You see all your accounts in one place. You can have, of course, a personal investment account, but I do recommend a retirement account there. You can have a joint account with your spouse. You'll see every trade they make on your behalf right there in the dashboard. You'll see how they're optimizing your investment, how they're reducing taxes. Now they've got, they've grown 20 times in the last 2 years because this is such a good idea. They now have $2.4 billion in client assets. Wealthfront.com/triangulation. When you sign up, you'll get your free personalized investment portfolio. They're going to ask you questions, risk, you know, how much risk you like, all of that stuff, so that they can design a custom allocation when you plan to retire, things like that, for a fraction of the cost, a fraction of the cost of the typical advisor. Just for today, for TWIT listeners, they're going to manage your first $15,000 without any charge forever. So start, get going, no charge for the first $15,000 when you go to wealthfront.com/triangulation. And that's not temporary, that's forever. But you know what's going to happen is you're going to put more money in, you're going to be happy, you're going to retire rich and fat and happy. For compliance purposes, I have to tell you, Wealthfront Incorporated is an SEC-registered investment advisor. Brokerage services are offered through Wealthfront Brokerage Corporation, member FINRA and SIPC. This is not a solicitation to buy or sell securities. Investing in securities involves risks, and there is the possibility of losing money. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Please visit Wealthfront.com to read their full disclosure. I love this, and I can't do it. It's driving me crazy. Wealthfront.com/triangulation. Lance Ulanoff is our guest, editor-in-chief at PC Magazine. That's when I first became aware of you. He's at Windows Magazine as well, and Home PC. It was so funny. Currently, he's at Mashable, by the way, chief correspondent there. It's so funny. There was a whole movement. You can chart the history of the PC industry by looking at magazine titles. So there was a whole movement. Everybody thought, oh, the home PC is the next big thing. Ziff Davis, family PC. There was home PC from CMP. That's the other thing I should fill you in if you're not up on all of this. There were three big companies, and they all hated each other. There was Ziff Davis. That's the one Lance and I worked for. You also worked for CMP at Windows Magazine. Right. And then there was IDG. And they did InfoWorld and something. Those were the three that were like, It was a tough competition in the 90s between.
It's true. It was tough competition, but it was also the most incestuous industry.
Oh, everybody crossed back and forth. Yeah. Yeah.
Michael Miller came from IDG and went over to PC Mag. And, you know, do you see people going back and forth and back and forth? And, you know, obviously I went from Ziff to CMP to a brief stint at a full-on internet company back to Ziff. I mean, that was not uncommon.
It's like NFL football today. They're arch rivals until you start working for them, and then suddenly you've switched teams.
Well, I think the rivalry was, it was both at a company level and to a certain extent, you wanted to beat the pants off people. But I have to say that I think that there was throughout the industry, there was this grudging respect for these other players because you knew they were doing a good job. See, technology writers know good technology writing. They know good coverage when they see it, and so they would appreciate it. And it was great, and it was great for the industry, and it was great for readers because everybody was upping their game. I mean, we were all learning about this technology together. We were taking people on the ride. You know, PC Mag would write a story. I remember one of the things they trained me on was that you know, you have to approach it as if the person really doesn't know what you're talking about. So don't go into shorthand, don't go into jargon. You know, you really need to introduce things. And so we were, I think in that way, we were always bringing in new people into the tent. We were training them in all of, you know, because technology was constantly changing. It was moving so fast. And it's moving fast now, but there was a, it was more, obviously it was a more DIY industry. There was a lot more about speeds and feeds. That's been subsumed, where it's much more now about the interface. And, you know, it's, you know, you can try and tear apart a tablet. And I know iFixit does it all the time, but that's, the focus has sort of moved off of that.
Oh, gosh, yes. They become appliances.
Yeah.
I look
at
how my kids, think about computers. You know, I come from that speeds and feeds day. So I'm always saying to them, hey, you've had that, I said, my son, you've had that MacBook Air for a couple of years. You want a new one? He says, no, it's fine. It's like, no, you don't get this. You've got the fifth generation Intel core processor. No, it's fine.
How much memory do you have? Can I get more memory? Do you know how many times at every job for years I was always like, can I get more memory?
Right.
Please, can I get more memory?
Right.
I would learn how to take apart the computer just so I can add more memory. We'd hoard memory chips. You know, we'd hoard them. I'd have them sitting on my desk sometime going, well, someday I'm going to put those on my computer.
I still have boxes of memory chips, because at one time you would put the chip in, the little holes, and this original DIMMs that, of course, are not compatible with any current hardware and can never be used
again. Basically useless. Put them in a land.
I know. at the time, it was extraordinarily expensive, even for, you know, 640K. It cost you thousands of dollars.
Yeah, it really was. And it was, you know, when I remember getting a memory upgrade on a Mac SE30, and a technician had to come in with a screwdriver that was like this long. Yeah. I don't know if you remember that. It would like go into like a slot.
It had to go way down in that hole. Yeah.
And I was very excited that now I knew how to do this. I was going to upgrade all the Mac SE30s I came upon without realizing that, you know, within a couple of years, they'd be the memory would be obsolete. Yeah, I could double that for half the price.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yes, we. It's like two old men talking about the past. Yes.
Remember in those days?
I remember when.
But what I love about you, Lance, is that in the 90s, in 96, you already were saying, "Nah, forget this print stuff." And now you're at Mashable, which is, I think, arguably one of the most forward-thinking blogs. Tell me a little bit about Mashable, because, you know, I remember Pete starting it around about the same time we started Twit in 2005. And Pete was, I love Pete, he's a Scottish guy, very shy. I think he was a teenager when he started it. He was very young.
He was 19. He was 19 and he was at home.
At home? Years,
yeah, he was at home. He started in his bedroom. He was sick at the time and he needed something to do. And he is very bright. And he started this up. And it was really about the sort of coming together of technologies to make something new, especially on the social side, you know, where the whole Mashable idea came
from. Mashups, yeah.
Yeah, mashups. And it's funny, you know, funny story. The first time I met Pete in person prior to working with him was just adjacent to your setup at CES.
Oh, we had that little
maybe book. He had just been on there and standing, and I realized who he was, and we just started talking. And yeah, like you said, he was pretty shy, but he was very interesting. In any case, Mashable has transformed from something that looked at the entire world through a sort of a digital lens to looking at the entire world. We are covering a world of news that spans from straight news, what's happening in the Ukraine, to Windows 10 coming out this week, you know, that. Where and the spectrum goes all the way through entertainment, lifestyle, travel. We have all these, you know, when I joined in 2011, I was editor in chief and we had just launched the channels and now we've enriched them. We just added a travel channel. We have, we have space, we have science.
Tell me about that. Tell me, because it's not just you. The Verge does, the Vox is doing this with The Verge. Mm-hmm. Is the sense that it's too narrow an audience? If you the tagline for Mashable now is the leading source for news, information, and resources for the connected generation. Right. So, is that enough of a cohesive goal? I mean, of course, you're going to say I'm not going to ask you to say anything against your company, but what happened? Why did we tried on Twit? We had cooking and other shows, and we realized that our audience is kind of obstinately, devotedly tech enthusiasts, and we decided to be niche-y. Is it that the niche is not big enough for to make money?
I think it depends. You know, different businesses I've been in, different places I've been in, have attempted this and realized that their audience wanted to do what they wanted to do or wanted to consume what they wanted to consume. One brief example is a place I called worked at called Deja, which had a ton of conversation, news group conversation going on.
And oh, thought, yeah, Deja News.
That's right. I worked there
you
for
worked
about...
You worked there.
Yeah, I did, for the most intense year and a half of my life.
But, I loved Deja News.
Well, it was a great place for talking about
right.
technology. And what we thought is, what if they could buy the stuff that they were talking about? If we had, here's the word, it's highlighted, and you go to a shopping engine, and it was a massive project. And it actually looked and worked fantastic. We did all these vertical channels. I mean, everything from appliance to travel. We had everything because everybody was talking about everything on Deja. But the reality is our audience wasn't with us. They only wanted to talk about it. They weren't going to buy anything.
Yeah, they didn't want to buy
it. And so they were ignoring this business we had built, and ultimately the whole thing imploded. With Mashable, what we realized as we were going along, there had always been this intention of turning this into a sort of media company. And it went at fits and starts at first because we weren't able to invest enough to cover the world the way we needed to. So we do a little bit, and it wouldn't really fly. But we'd get some, you felt like you were getting nibbles of the audience, like they were almost with you. When we got our first round of investment, because we're a totally private company, but we have funding now, that gave us the wherewithal to expand in the key areas. And I got to give a lot of credit to Jim Roberts because this is something he really understands.
He's the guy who came over from the New York Times. And in
fact,
it was very stunning at the time. And a lot of people said, this is very telling. Here's this guy who's got a highly prestigious position at the New York Times coming to an internet startup to run it.
Yeah, and he really understands world news, national news, knows exactly how to cover it, knows how to build a team to do so. And, you know, hired, you know, we had a good team. He's brought in a ton of great people who have done an excellent job. And I think I believed in this. When I really said, yes, we can do this, is when we did our Ukraine coverage. Because there's a sort of semi-esoteric topic that you think, why is our audience going to care about this? You know, how does it impact them? We covered that crap out of it, the Ukrainian elections and the Russian and the separatist movement and the downing of the airplane. And our audience grew and grew and grew. And so we figured out how to cover a spectrum of news. And of course, we still cover the silly stuff, the fun stuff, the nostalgic stuff, the culture stuff, the pop stuff, and the tech stuff. Because quite honestly, at the core of Mashable are early adopters, enthusiasts who love technology and who love to be the first to try something out. So it's been a remarkable thing. And I really believe that in the case of Mashable, what has been different and one of the reasons we've succeeded maybe where others have failed is that we actually already had the right audience in place. Unusually, we had a 50-50 mix of male-female.
That's very unusual.
Right away,
That's
right. That's not a tech.
We're 95% male.
That's right. Okay, we had that.
And I'm sure PC Magazine was.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And we're also skewed, PC Magazine skewed older. We were always trying to bring it down in age, but we really never succeeded. We did better online, but not tremendously well. Our audience at Mashable is 18 to 34. They're affluent or they're early adopters. They're also international. So all of these things, and that was all true of us before we really went hard on doing the world of news. So we actually had the right audience in place. And that is something that you just can't say of all the other guys. If our audience wasn't with us, if we weren't seeing the traffic, the social growth, the unique growth, then we wouldn't be doing this anymore. We'd be rolling back. But that's not the case. I mean, day in, day out, I look at the stories that do well and I'm like, we've got them. We are competing with CNN and USA Today and we're doing okay.
Now, you have 43 million uniques, which is a month, which is not a bad start. But one of the things that has changed is people don't go to the front page of a website as much as they used to.
No,
they go
they
to
don't.
Facebook, they go to Twitter, they deep link into your site.
And
that's a big shift too, isn't it?
It's a big shift, but again, Meshul has probably been well positioned for that. We have well over 10 million followers across the social networks. It's probably more like 12 to 15 by
I'd
now.
I'd say you recognize that sooner than anybody.
Yeah,
and
that right, and
that
was, and so that is a core of our audience, and we're fine with them not coming to our homepage because we know that when we drop a story in Facebook or we drop a story in Twitter, it is going to get noticed and it's going to get clicks. It's critical. It's a really weird thing, having spent so many years working on different homepage designs, to realize how little it matters. But there's a part of me that cannot help because, you know, having used the homepage, that I'm always like, oh, I want to see my story on the homepage. I want to see it in the big spot. And it's nice for me, but I always have to remind myself, most of the readers probably never saw it that way. They saw it. You know how they saw it? They saw it on this. This is how they saw it. They saw it on the phone.
On the phone,
you know,
yes.
Right. That's the screen that they're viewing most of, you know, like, at least 50% of our audience are viewing it on mobile now. It may be 60 at this point.
Wow.
And that's, I mean, what a stunning turn of events. I mean, I remember being at Ziff and talking about a PCMag.com redesign and talking about doing it in the TV aspect ratio. Do you remember that?
4:3.
There was this period of time where everybody, right, everybody was like, it's got to be TV size because, you know, it's all going to be video.
Yeah.
But it was a misunderstanding. It's like, we didn't realize that the screens were going to get smaller. And it was going to be a scrolling world. It's like everything you thought you knew. It's like throwing
out the window. I suspect it's the same today. I mean, this changes so rapidly. A lot of sites were caught off guard by the fact that the homepages, the front page is meaningless.
Yeah, and they don't like it when you say it to them because I think some have still not accepted it. And
yeah.
I think, you know, but it in a way, it's fantastic because it transforms your business so you don't spend so much time worrying about micromanaging a page that doesn't mean anything. Because I was at PC Mag when we were trying to do that. It meant something then, but it was also a time suck.
Yeah. That's the old newspaper thinking, that the front page of the newspaper is what matters.
That's right. That's right.
Nobody sees the front page anymore.
Very linear.
Yeah.
That's not what happens.
You do something interesting. For instance, and I think this is telling on the when you look at an article on the front page, you see at the bottom maybe the most important thing, the number of shares and a graph, a heat graph showing how the shares, how the reshares and the links are going up. So you can
that's
fascinating.
Yeah, it's really interesting for us to watch. I think we enjoy it probably more than even our readers.
Maybe, but I do think that there's a little something when you say that to a reader. This is hot.
Yeah.
It's a little communication there. You know, it looks like it is something that for internal use only. But no, I think there's a little communication there that, no, everybody's sharing this Bill Hader never-before-seen Saturday Night Live sketch. So you should share that too. See that spike there?
Yeah, you know? And that spike. You know, it's funny. We were just talking about this. That spike usually indicates
that's
that
Facebook.
It just dropped on Facebook.
That's Facebook.
Right.
That's the
that's
Facebook
right. That's
spike.
That's a Facebook drop.
Yep.
Yeah. So I, you know, the other interesting thing that we do, because we have probably more technology for measuring audience response than like anyone else.
That's interesting. You invested in that.
Yeah, we invested in it. So we actually will know when a story is going to be hot. We have an engine called Velocity that is totally proprietary, and we use editorially, and we've also turned it into a business for some third-party clients, and it is something you look at and you go, oh, that story's on the rise, and if you write a story about that thing that you learned about, 9 times out of 10, it's going to blow up. It's a pretty accurate measurement of the sentiment that exists outside of our own site. And so it's really interesting, you know, so it's become part art, part science to work on a site like this.
That is also a very big change. I always thought of it as the tail wagging the dog, which is if you start chasing the audience, but this maybe is old, I admit I'm old school. This is old school thinking. If you start chasing the audience, they'll have moved on by the time you get to them. But you now can, you're so much more responsive. You have so much more information. You have it in real time. How much are your coverage decisions made based on that? I mean, is that influencing what you cover?
percentage of what we cover. There's certainly a number of stories that we do that are based on that, but we're also doing the sort of pure play, this is your beat.
Okay. Go so you're still going to do those stories?
Oh, absolutely. We're definitely still doing those stories. I mean, you know, we had such a great week. I guess it was 2 weeks ago, all the space stories with Pluto. And we have this, you know, Miriam is our space reporter. Fantastic. She was out there. She was at the press conference and asking these incredible questions. And, you know, I was nerding out because I love space stories.
Me too.
And I love when they're on the site. I get super excited. And then we convey the excitement in our stories and our audience gets excited and they start to click on. And that's about our call. That's not on Velocity.
I would almost ask, why bother putting stories up there just because you believe in them? Why not just do what the audience tells you?
Because the audience doesn't always know what it wants. It doesn't always know what's important. It doesn't know what it can't know, meaning that when something is secret or has to be investigated, they can't possibly know. But when you tell them, they're interested, they're shocked, they're angry, they're happy, they're concerned, they want change. And we really believe that's, and I think that's like anybody who went to journalism school, you believe that's an important part of the process. That's kind of why you got into it in the first place, to reveal something, to enlighten. And you want to do that. And I think when you're only delivering the things they already know, you're not enlightening them. You're entertaining them, and that's fine. I'm totally fine with entertaining, but I want to mix it up and tell them something surprising.
So you balance the two.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's a mix. We have different teams. The site kind of auto manages the flow, but you know, we have different channels pushing stuff.
Well, that's interesting. So what appears on the front page and where it appears on the front page is programmatic.
With the exception of that top area. So you see that top area, the fillet comment,
yeah,
lander, all of that is editorially managed. Everything below it is actually based on that heat chart you're seeing. That's
you're
how things end up in the first column, the second column, or the third column.
Interesting.
Yeah. Got a lot of technology behind this site. Actually, it's funny. There's a guy, Robin Peterson, former Ziffer. He's the CTO here. His team built all that.
It's real. I'm just absolutely fascinated. And I think Mashable's a very good example of a site that's doing right. There are a handful of them that seem to really be doing well. But I always felt like the key to Mashable's success was its shareability. It's not Upworthy style shareability.
No.
You don't fall for the listicles or the you won't believe what happened next crap. You have content, and people want to share
lists.
That content.
We definitely have lists, but we're shy of Upworthy. I mean, I think Upworthy realized they were being too Upworthy and has kind of peeled back from that.
Well, you know why? Because Facebook deprecated them.
Yeah,
so let's take a break, and we're going to talk about the influence of Facebook in all of this and what you think of Facebook's new publishing platform and more. We're talking to Lance Ulanoff. You know, I didn't really plan to get into all of this. I wanted to talk about history, but you know what? This is fascinating, too. Lance could talk about many things. He's chief correspondent at Mashable, many years editor-in-chief of PC Magazine, Windows Magazine, Home PC, and whatever that Long Island newspaper was you reported school board meetings for some time ago. Do you do a stand-up? Do you stand at a desk or you sit down?
I sit.
I think lot of people, if you go into offices like Mashable now, it's kind of a mix. There's a lot of people standing up.
Yes, there is. We have stand-up desks, and I get up and walk enough, so, you know.
You're obviously, you're like in good shape. You probably do marathons and stuff like that.
No, I just a little workout at home.
Okay.
I'll, you know, the next time I'm on, I'll explain my whole workout routine.
Oh, well, maybe next break. I want to talk about standing desks. A lot of people have kind of been sold by the standing desk, but how do you do the standing desk at your office where, you know, you're in a cubicle or you're in an office where they provide the Veridesk. This is so cool. We've got one here. Do we have some video of it? I think we do now. This is a desk that you put on your desk, and it lets you either stand up or sit down, which is awesome. Sometimes you get tired. You want to sit down. I like having both available. The average office worker spends 5 hours, 41 minutes sitting at their desk every day. Being sedentary is not good for you. And according to research conducted by the Mayo Clinic, put you at a much greater risk for a whole range of health problems, shortening your lifespan. I look at Jammer B, John, who started standing up at home, and he's lost weight. He looks great. This is how the Veridesk works. You put it right on the desk at your office or in your cubicle. You don't have to have, there's no assembly, no installation, no boss approval required. It comes ready to go, fully assembled. And then it's very easy. There are 11 different height settings. It's counterbalanced, so you can put as much as 35 pounds. I mean, a monitor, a computer, lots of stuff on that desk. And it, with just one finger, you raise it and lower it. And because, now they sell a variety of standing desks, but because this Varidesk is so simple, it's only $275 plus shipping. So instead of buying an expense, you know, some of these standing desks are $1,000 or more, $275, and you've got the benefits of a standing desk. No wonder Lifehacker named Varidesk one of their five best standing desks. It's been featured on Product Hunt and Gear Patrol. We're using the Pro Plus 36. Varidesk, Varidesk.com. You want to learn more about Varidesk, visit the website. And when you purchase one, tell them you heard it on Twit, because we'd love to get a little credit. Varidesk.com, Varidesk.com. We thank them so much for their support of triangulation. And isn't that cool? Boss doesn't have to say yes. You just put it in there and you will be feeling better. If your watch, if your Apple Watch tells you to stand up, you could say, shut up, I'm already standing up. We were talking to Lance Ulanoff. He's the editor-in-chief. I was the editor-in-chief of Mashable. He's now chief correspondent. Editor-in-chief is a management role.
Right.
Chief correspondent, you get to have fun.
Well, I am definitely out there writing. In fact, one of the stories I did probably a month, maybe it's a month ago, a month and a half ago, is I went to the DARPA Robotics Challenge.
Oh, that was so cool. You got to go see that?
I did. I saw it in person. It was quite a, it was 2 days, actually. It was really something else. You know, they just, the teams, the robots that they built, the tension, there was crowd, there was a crowd cheering. to be fair, the robots at times could move very slowly, but they would fall down, they would get up, they would climb stairs. It was, and you know, so I was covering it. I did a number of stories from that, and I got to recently do a three-part series on on Tesla, who drives the Tesla, traveled around the country talking to people.
Oh, that's interesting.
Riding in their cars. Because, you know, there are this group of early adopters. Yeah, there's the falling down video of these robots.
We played We played it over and over again.
It's so funny because you feel kind of badly for the robots.
But you also exult for the human race.
Yeah, it's just something else. And you'd hear that when this would happen, when that robot fell, I kind of remember that moment when it just went back. You heard like this.
Oh,
blast.
Yeah.
Because they just like. They have these, sort of hydraulic systems. Sort of poof. There's one. There was one that went up the stairs and it raised its. They had it raise its arms in triumph, and then it sort of like lost it and just started falling over. Getting to do those kinds of stories has been fun. It's been sort of a bit of a throwback for me. You know, reminds me of my early days. At one of the jobs I did not mention at all is my years in trade publications when I was writing for something called Electrical Wholesaling and traveling around the country talking to electrical distributors.
Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, I did. I learned a lot. It was really, really interesting. But it also could sound like, if you talked about it, quite boring because it was like, covering like the people who sold louvers and switches. And I must have edited, I can't even tell you my stories I edited about how to be a better salesman. But it was, being out there on the road is really interesting because, you get it's that feel. You get the opportunity to not just write about the technology, but you get to set the scene. You get to create, convey the characters, the people. I rode 2 hours, maybe it was 3 hours in the dead of night in a Tesla. In the northernmost part of Minnesota for a story. It was so cold and really, really dark.
But, I think that's what makes a good reporter, though, is somebody who is fascinated even by things like how to be a better electronics wholesaler. And you can find a nugget, a juice in anything, and that makes a good reporter.
Yeah. I was always interested in learning more. It's funny you say it because the truth is approaching these things, I'd be like, oh, that sounds boring.
Right.
And I'd start to talk to the people. And then I'd start to look around. And it was always, you know, I remember arriving in San Francisco at an electrical distributor. It was 9 months after the earthquake. And he took me in there, and we're looking around the factory or the inventory place, and basically takes me to the back, and there's a wall with the biggest crack in it I've ever seen. That's what happened. It's like it went from a 25-foot height all the way down to go crack. He said, you know, we survived, but, you know, and that was part of it. That was part of the story, how they'd, as a business and as human beings, they had survived this calamitous event. I think that, you know, the advice I give people, you know, young writers when they're going into this is that, you know, you really have an opportunity to tell a great story no matter what you're talking about. And the only question is whether or not you're going to bring the interest and enthusiasm to it to tell that story in a way that excites people, because it's always there. It is always there. You just have to find it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I say the same thing, that everybody in interviews like this, everybody has a story. If it's a boring interview, it's your fault as the interviewer, because
right.
Everybody has a story to tell that's fascinating. Your job is to find that. And it's the same with the reporter. Your job is to find that thing that makes this something people can get excited about. Let's talk about Facebook. So, you know, there's different points of view. You pointed out that when something gets shared, as we saw with the graph on Facebook, it's like the spike. It has become more and more, and it wants to be more and more, the source of news. Those 18 to 49-year-olds that you guys talk to, probably more like 18 to 34, live on Facebook. And the Pew studies show that they get most of their news from Facebook now.
Right.
So Facebook has a lot of power and probably more power than companies like Mashable would like. Are you going to participate in the Facebook news, that new news publishing thing?
I don't know. I don't know if we will or not.
Pros and cons on that.
Well, the cons would be, you know, can you, if Facebook is the destination, can you be confident that people will go from Facebook to Mashable? Because if it's all there, they don't have to.
They could consume. Facebook could consume Mashable.
Well, obviously, if they're consuming your content, it's critical that they are also consuming the stuff that supports your content,
right?
Which is the advertising.
Right.
And I don't see exactly how that works on Facebook. It's just the same thing as YouTube. You know, you can get tens of thousands of views on YouTube. They're ultimately only valuable to you as a business if you control the advertising that runs around it. And as we know, YouTube really doesn't allow most people to do that. So, you know, in general, you're going to make very little unless you're one of the big guys. You know, you're at a whole other level. So now here's Facebook with saying, publish your stuff on our site. Why? What do I get from it? You know, okay, brand building, sure. But do I get enough people coming back to, will they? There's always a second click that you want. They read a story on Facebook. If the second click is a story that lives on Mashable, do they read it? Oftentimes, that's not going to happen because people are not clicking another link on the same site. They're going from site to site to site.
Right.
That's the way it is now. So I'm in the position of sort of, let's see. I'm sure we'd be willing to try it, but, you know, this is a really savvy company. We will do what works for us and what works for our audience.
It's really an interesting challenge because we debate this. Jeff and Jarvis and I on Twig have debated it many times, and there. Nowadays, whether it's Facebook or YouTube or Twitter, you're often living in somebody else's ecosystem. That's where the people are, but it's very difficult for you to make a business out of that. Plus, you're at the mercy of Facebook if they, as they have done many times, change the algorithm.
Yeah, well, I think that's a tough thing for everybody, is that, you know, Facebook sneezes, the world gets a cold because they have just changed everything. And suddenly what you thought, you know, that's why, you know, going back to your earlier question from a while ago, why should Mashable do all these other stories? Because, yes, we can depend on the listicles and the funny stuff and the viral stuff to work on Facebook. But if Facebook changes and it's not working there anymore, we have to find something else. So we really need to make sure that our other content is working for us. Pure play stuff is working for us that we can put anywhere and drive traffic.
The world is changing, and it's changing very, very rapidly. And it's difficult for content creators to know what to do. Do you view, what is the job of Mashable? Is it a content creator, or is it more than that?
Oh, well, it is a little bit more than that. Certainly, we do conferences.
Well, that's one reason, right? People do, they diversify a little bit just in case.
There's other things that we do. I mean, we're primarily a content creator, but, we have events of all kinds. We do a lot of stuff on social media where it's different kinds of content.
You've done very well sharing on social media.
Yeah. And we really live in all of these different environments. We live in Snapchat. We live in Instagram. We live in Twitter. And we know how to work each of those environments to our advantage and also to the advantage of the people following us. They get some really great and engaging content on all of these
platforms. I love your vines. Those vines are fun.
Oh, yeah. Vines are a really good time. Yeah, I like making vines. I love making vine animations. And these guys who do them, our Mashable team, are absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. We hired real people to do these things. We didn't say, in addition to your job writing stories, make creative vines.
Right.
Now, certainly reviewers and editors who want to can make vines. They can do that, and some of them do. But if you want to give quality and quantity, you need people dedicated to it.
And what does this get you?
It gets you eyeballs, without a doubt.
Yeah.
It builds your brand. Sometimes it does drive traffic back to the brand. But
it's more branding, though, right? It's just
it makes you a part. It makes you part of that whole environment, which is critical. Otherwise, if you're not talking to these people, your audience, where they live, you're not talking to them at all. You've lost them.
Right.
You have to engage with them.
Right. Well, here's an example. You've got all these people on your Vine anyway. So occasionally you'll throw in some promotion for an event or a party. Or you've launched a new transportation page, and so now people can see that. So this is actually a clever use of it, that you certainly don't fill the Vine with promotional announcements. Mostly you fill it with great fun stuff. But this is costly. Yeah. This content is not cheap to produce.
No. These people are talented. And it's something that we are really committed to because it's always been part of our brand.
You have to have a larger view, though, of what you're up to. So is it building community? Is it reaching out to people wherever they are? You're kind of like Satya Nadella at Microsoft saying, hey, we're going to produce apps for iPad because that's where our customers are.
Yeah. Well, we've always been like that. Pete Cashmore has always been really, really interested in where people are going next. When we went to South by Southwest this year, it was the South by Southwest of Meerkat. And eventually Periscope, it was so I can't tell you how much live video streaming we did.
You did a ton.
A lot of it was driven by Pete Cashmore, he was obsessed with it.
Yeah.
He gets that way and he's always right.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. I watch a lot of Pete's videos from South by.
Yeah. It was fun. I did a walking, meerkat with him. Through the streets of South by. It must have lasted 2 hours. And we we found people that worked for Meerkat. It was just crazy. It was the most interesting thing at South by because the rest of it wasn't super interesting.
Yeah. Well, no, in fact, I 4 years ago, I went to South by myself, basically with a camera because Robert Scoble said, well, the only interesting thing is the parties. So I covered the parties at South by Southwest. We stopped covering it because we felt like, well, there's no tech content there. But you've made it interesting. It was very clever to use Meerkat there to gain brand awareness.
Yeah, well, to show people the way. This is the hottest new thing. And we're always the first people to use it.
And we use it, yeah.
Yeah, and that got people excited. And, Twitter followed very quickly with Periscope. And we were, I was on the roof of this building probably within a few weeks of that using both Periscope and Meerkat to live stream a fire that was happening a few blocks.
I remember that. That was a big breakthrough for Periscope. Yeah.
So, it was, I, I, I love using new tools. You know, I did a whole talk about storytelling in the 21st century, and was explaining how these tools are all part of it now. And you have to adopt them and try them and have your pockets full of stuff so you can tell the story in any number of different ways. And you're pulling different audiences, and you're focusing eyeballs on you and the story.
We're talking to Lance Uhlenhoff, chief correspondent at Mashable, a guy who's been part of the computer and technology scene for 20 years, and lots more to come in just a second. But first, I want to mention a breakthrough in terms of borrowing money. If you needed a little money in the past, where you go to your brother Louie, better that than the loan shark Freddie, or you go to the bank hat in hand and you feel like lower than low. Prosper solves this. This is Silicon Valley's answer to the bank loan. Peer-to-peer lending. Prosper is a marketplace, not a bank, but a marketplace that connects people who want to borrow money with those who have money to lend. It's such a great solution. You can get a low fixed rate loan right now with Prosper.com, up to $35,000 in as few as 5 days. You can use the money for just about anything you want. A good one, we always mention, pay off those high rate credit cards or fix up the house or put it into your business. Prosper's online marketplace is friction free. And by going to Prosper.com/twit right now, you can find out exactly how much you can get at exactly what your low rate will be, and it won't affect your good credit. Prosper, PR, look at that, Prosper. Now, that's not for you. That's Jason. Prosper.com/twit. Right now, you'll get a $50 Visa gift card with your low-interest loan, up to $35,000 in as few as 5 days, and a $50 Visa gift card, P-R-O-S-P-E-R, Prosper.com/twit. It's a better way to borrow. Lance Uhlenhoff, our guest. We're talking about the past, the present, and now let's talk about the future. A lot of people have kind of grim visions for the future of journalism, for the future of sites like Mashable. You see this kind of fragmentation, Facebook's influence, Twitter's influence. You guys, though, seem to really have your finger on what do you think is going to happen? I mean, how do you stay on top of change? It changes so rapidly.
I don't know. I feel like my career has been nothing but change.
Yeah, no kidding.
Going, from the day I started in publishing in 1986 to now, it's been a sea change. And it's been happening it's not like it happened at the end or in the middle. It was just constantly happening. Every time I was in a situation, I was watching the industry change. And usually the industry was trying to hold it back.
Right.
We're not ready. The difference is now that I think that the industry understands that change is inevitable and they have to adjust for it and see if they can get ahead of it. Like I've said, Mashable is, it's a much easier time of getting ahead of those changes because we have that sort of that fluidity. We're able to, when you are an online site, when you're an online media outlet, it's easier to pull things up and pull things down, put things up, change, move people around if you need to, change the mix of content and adopting these new tools and telling stories in different ways. But the shakeout, I think that the shakeout for the industry is going to continue for a while. I mean, we're no means done. It's not dire because the reality is people... The reason I used the word storyteller in my talk was that humans are natural storytellers. It's part of our heritage. It's part of what we were doing since the days in the caves, where we were really reporting what had happened by painting that story on the cave wall. That really hasn't changed. We're still trying to tell a story. So it's just a question of the medium, right? How we do it. So that's not going away. But, it's going to be still going to be tough for mainstream, so-called mainstream media, the stuff that had been around for a long time. And I'm not just talking print, I'm talking broadcast. They were all trying to figure it out and changing. I did a talk probably at this point, it's got to be like 6 years ago or something like that. At least 6 years ago, where I was talking about niche publications and I remember I was very tired. I'd come off a red eye to do a panel, And so the filter was off. And I was kind of saying, the way I was talking about the industry was really unvarnished. I was sort of, I'm sitting with somebody from like an ESPN magazine and someone else from it, like all these magazine people. And I'm the only online guy. And I said, you know, they're like, they're hemming and hawing. Well, you know, magazines will always have dominance. And I'm finally, I'm like, I go, let me put it to you this way. You know, all those Hudson newsstands, 5 years from now, all of them will be half the size they are now.
Wow.
Because there won't be the publication to support them. And all, I said, all those niche publications, it's all going away. It's going to get tighter and tighter and tighter. Yep. You're going to see. And after the talk, I was at the cocktail party after, and this woman runs up to me. She's like, so you think my stores are going to be half the size in 5 years? She's the executive. She's the executive director for Hudson News.
Oh, boy.
And I'm like, I'm still like, I don't care because I'm completely out of it. I'm like, yep.
Yep.
That's what's going to happen. And I have to say, I was 100% right.
You were 150% right, because most of those Hudson newsstands are gone. We had an amazing newsstand I used to love to frequent. It had all these, every magazine. It was down at the Powell Street cable car turnaround in San Francisco. It's a hat shop now because there's nothing to sell.
Yeah. No, and there's no need for those kind, you know, to a niche publication to spend the money,
the
expense of print and distribution when they can do the same thing and build a following online. If they're smart, if they know how to do it, it can definitely be done.
I've seen it done. It's still a challenge, though. You can get sucked in by link bait. There's the upward days of the world. I look at a company like Gawker, which is going through really kind of a massive introspective decision-making process as they could implode. They could, now Nick Denton says we're going to become respectable. We'll see. You understand how Gawker got to be Gawker. I mean, first of all, Nick had those sensibilities, but it's like crack cocaine. It's the crack cocaine of publishing. You get all these hits for these scurrilous articles, and you go, well, I got to do more of those. How do you keep from doing that at Mashable, getting drawn into what is, I think, ultimately going to be a dead end?
Well, I think we've always taken a positive outlook on test technology. We're not here to tear anybody down. We want facts. We want truth. We want information. We want utility. We don't want gossip. We're not interested in gossip. When something really happens, when it's a real thing, we'll report on that. Even if it's somewhat salacious because it's happening and it's real and it's important to a group of people, we'll report on that. I mean, we've certainly reported on celebrity things, but we're not reporting on gossip, and we're not trying to tear people down or write based on innuendo.
I think, though, that's the challenge in this so fast-paced, so competitive media world that, you know, you got to make a living, and what happens is there's this very seductive direction you can go in. In order not to go there, you have to really have core values, don't you?
Yeah, you have to know who you are. You have to know what your audience expects. You have to have as part of your mission. What is your mission? And if you know what your mission is, that if you're here to deliver the news, information, and utility, it's pretty easy not to go astray. We have, we've hired people who are of like minds. We have editorial meetings. We talk about these story ideas.
You must have this battle, though. This young kids must come in and say, come on, we could do this story. We'd get a million clicks.
We don't hire those kids.
Good for you.
We hire people who want to work hard, who are talented, who can write, who can smell a good story, who can pitch it properly, who can follow through and write it, and write it in a way that it sings, that it's informational but also completely entertaining.
And tells a story. I love that.
Tells a story. And, it's... I think it's those people when you see them, when you meet them, and they follow through. And the people who don't do that don't stick around. But we have a great track record here. In fact, the interns that have come in here, there have been a number of them that have gone on to actually work here and do great things. And that I feel is a tribute to us that we've done a good job of finding good people.
That is part of it, isn't it? It's fun, getting a good team together. People who, not particularly for Mashable, but people who have written for blogs like TechCrunch always tell me, It is a rat race that you have to file. There's this nonstop pressure to come up with something good. Is it like that at Mashable, or is it a little bit more relaxed? What's the life like?
There's certainly pressure to come up with something good. You want to have a good story. I mean, this is the best kinds of newsrooms have a certain degree of competitiveness.
Urgency.
You want that. You want people to compete a little bit against each other. It makes me crazy when people are like, this is happening. I'm going to get to it. No, they don't. It's prioritization. It's about dropping things, turning on a dime and writing. But it's not about quantity, because quantity is not going to get you anywhere. It's really about the impact of individual stories. No one's got a story count, but people are expected to cover their beats and not miss a story that is important.
Well, and you have people like Christina Warren who have just this incredible creative streak, and they get joy out of creating, out of making, and so it's never a burden for them to see the new way to something new, something exciting, the new way to tell that story.
The native energy and excitement, because Christina is a good example of somebody who is a proxy for her readers. She is as invested in these topics as they are. So the passion
that comes across
comes through.
Yep. So important. Hey, Lance, great to talk to you. We've talked so many times, but I never had a time to spend and just talk about life and stuff and philosophy. And I'm very interested in what's happening in the media. So I'm glad. I think Mashable's lucky to have people like you at the head with some vision about the right way to do this. And obviously, with 43 million uniques a month, you're doing it. You're doing something right.
I don't think so.
I appreciate your time. Thank you, Lance Ulanoff.
Thank you, Leo, for having me on. I appreciate it.
It was great. Chief Correspondent at Mashable, at Lance Ulanoff on Twitter. If you were going to retire in the next few years, what would you like to do? What's your dream that you'd like to pursue?
I love movies. I love photography. I love drawing.
You're an artist.
Yeah. In quotes, artist. So, yeah, it's... I sometimes think I'd just like to go around just taking pictures because I really enjoy doing that. You'll see in my Instagram feed that I have this fascination with the moon, and I just take these pictures with my big lens and I get excited about that. But I also like to draw, so that's very relaxing for me. But the other thing I love is entertainment and the movies and TV and doing something with that in my golden years, whenever those come, might be fun. But yeah, so I don't know. I just like to be busy and totally engaged. So nice. I can't, whatever ends up happening, that's what I want to do.
By the way, I saw that picture of the moon because I follow you on Instagram. That was a nice shot. What did you do? What did you shoot that with?
That's with a Sony Alpha NEX5 with a 200mm lens, nice. Stopped, I obviously shoot manual to do that. And, yep. I actually did not use a tripod.
What? That's handheld?
Yeah.
You. Wow. It's so crisp.
A lot of practice.
Really nice. He's on the Twitter, too, Lance Ulanoff. Thank you, Lance, for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Leo. Take care.
Take care. We do triangulation normally at our normal time, Mondays, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. If you'd like to join us live, we'd love it because the chat room is such a big part of all of this. But if you can't, we make on-demand version of every show we do available, in this case at twit.tv/TRI or on youtube.com/triangulation. Or you could subscribe in your favorite podcatcher, wherever you get it. But do subscribe because it's one of those shows every week there's something interesting, something compelling, something fascinating. It's a really fun show for me to do, and I trust it's a fun show for you to listen to or watch. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.